Hello, Market Watcher. I'm David Ravel, and this is the weekend edition of Value Side. No more driving this summer? Worldwide, car sales are off. All that, and our look back at the week just passed. Well, it really must be the end of summer, as people seem less inclined to purchase any new cars. This week saw vehicle sales around the globe begin to decline, led by the United States, which up until now has had a red-hot used car sector. We saw substantial declines in car sales from Spain, Great Britain, Germany, and South Africa. This is a particularly interesting measure of consumer sentiment at a very critical time, as the world struggles to regain its economic footing after last year's economic shutdown. With the notable exception of Germany and Great Britain, we also saw retail sales decline across both Europe and Japan. Now, going forward, it will be critically important that consumer confidence, together with the consumer's willingness to spend, remain high. Without the consumer, which at least in this country represents about two-thirds of our economic activity, without that consumer, any hope for a recovery may be lost. So we'll be watching very carefully for any more signs that consumers are becoming more fearful and less willing to part with their hard-earned funds. Let's put all that together as we take a look back at the week just passed. Free enterprise is one of the great traditions and core values of the American culture. The ability of virtually everyone to own shares in publicly traded corporations is considered an almost sacred right in this country. And an essential part of that is the stock market that is open, fair, and free. All that comes together in what we call the free marketplace, a place where it is possible for anyone to build wealth and create the lifestyle of their dreams. Now, knowing that background has made the interaction between the world's two largest economies, the United States and China, all the more fascinating. As you no doubt know, it was the United States under then-President Richard Nixon who first approached China in an effort to open up that country to become more integrated into the world's family of nations, and by extension, into the world economy. China was invited to become a member of various international trade, political, and financial organizations. Now, without a doubt, China has excelled in trade and commerce. To say that China is now a vital part of the world's economy is, if anything, an understatement. In fact, today it could be argued that China is the number one trading hub of the world. On the other hand, the Chinese financial markets have not achieved the dominance of their manufacturing and industrial and trade sectors. Here, China has proceeded cautiously, and although they are politically communist, meaning that they do have direct state investment in public companies, they have been late in getting actively involved in the management of the financial markets, a practice that I think is dubious to begin with. But market management is something that here in America, on the other hand, we have been actively engaged in for at least as far back as the 1980s. And the stewardship of Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Reagan, and Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. It was, after all, Greenspan who proposed to President Reagan in the aftermath of the crash of 1987 that a plunge protection team should be formed, a team that would actively work to control any further market crashes. Today, we see the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve actively intervening in the financial markets, with the Fed currently purchasing a mind-numbing $120 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds and notes each month. Now, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen the Chinese struggle with how to deal with a sector crash of their own, One of the major Chinese technology sectors is the online education sector. It's a long story, but the Chinese authorities decided that this group of companies should essentially provide free education. It's a noble sentiment, but one which sent the stocks into a tailspin. New Orient Education dropped by half, Gaotu Tech Ed dropped by nearly two-thirds, and the industry leader in the group, Tal Education, dropped by almost three-quarters in price. The group was devastated, and investors around the world were distraught. So like the Americans so many years before, the Chinese elected to directly support, quote-unquote, the market by investing $4.5 billion U.S. in stabilizing it. Interesting, isn't it, how two sets of politicians from very different cultures and very different political backgrounds, separated by years, nonetheless chose as their best option to just throw money at the problem. It makes me wonder, is this the price of today's free market? Well, perhaps nowhere is the contrast between the economic systems of China and the U.S. more stark than in their approach to corporate reform. Here in America, this is a particularly pressing issue, as more and more the public sees the power and influence of especially major tech companies as way out of proportion. We see big tech actively taking part in shaping public opinion, filtering news, and banning certain voices from using their platform. In one particularly egregious case, a former president of the United States was banned from the Twitter platform. Now, many find these moves as infringing on what were perceived as basic constitutional rights, such as the right to free speech. And lawsuits have been brought against the offending companies. But in the American process of corporate reform, these cases will likely take years to come to adjudication, working their way ever so slowly through the American courts. By the time their final verdict is reached, society will have moved on, and those offending corporations will have moved on also, to many times new business ventures and new markets. Contrast that with what's occurring in China right now. Beijing is on a tear, directly confronting those companies in which the CCP sees as not acting in the public interest. Recently, we've seen Beijing take on the property companies, online retailer Alibaba, and just last week, online educators came under fire, companies like Tal Education. Last night, video games were the object of China's wrath, particularly a game called Game of Kings and its maker, Tencent. Apparently, Game of Kings is a particularly popular game among the Chinese younger set, with adolescents and young adults spending hours at their terminals playing the game. Chinese leaders had had enough, however, and they decided to speak up, to call out these video games as a real social vice. But unlike the American process of endless rhetoric and endless lawsuits, when the Chinese government speaks, people really do listen. And that was all it took. When the CCP published an article condemning the video games, investors were the first to react, selling the stock in Tencent in mass, dropping the price by 13% in yesterday's trading session. And Tencent management was not far behind, as they promised to reform their ways and limit the games. Now for the CCP, this was mission accomplished. In fact, so strong was the Chinese message that it has even impacted American companies this morning, with some of the selling spilling over to such companies as Activision Blizzard, Electronic Arts, Zynga, and Take-Two Interactive here in the U.S. markets this morning. Although most of us here in America would not be comfortable with a government as powerful as the Chinese, nonetheless, there are many who would like to see the American government take on more of the role of corporate reformer. Well, Wouldn't it be great if we could have an economic indicator that told us just when the production process begins? Going up when plants and factories begin to make things, and declining when they begin to cut back on their production. Well, that's essentially what the Purchasing Manager Index does. The purchasing manager is the person who begins the entire manufacturing process. He or she buys the raw materials or components needed to make their finished goods. When the purchasing manager begins to buy, that means production is about to pick up. Last night, 8 countries reported their latest Purchasing Managers Index, and it gives us a real insight into how the different countries are faring as we continue this economic recovery from last year's shutdown. Leading the way in the recovery is India. Now, we haven't heard yet from China, but based on recent results, I don't think that China will present as powerful a PMI as India just did. In July, India reported a 6-point gain in their PMI, by far the largest gain in the group, and double what anyone else has done. India is clearly gearing up for this economic expansion, as it is becoming apparent that India is gaining market share in international trade. Look for India to have a strong quarter based on this PMI reading. Next in the group for positive results is Germany. Although it trails far behind India's level, nevertheless, Germany reported a 2-point-plus gain for July. This indicates that Germany is far and away the strongest economy currently in Europe, based on the current Purchasing Managers Index. And along with Italy, it's the only European country to record a positive result for the month of July. Italy's results, however, were only fractionally higher. Now, the rest of the European countries all reported declines in their PMI. This means that their future production levels could be expected to decline over the next few weeks. Countries with declining PMI included France, although just fractionally, and Spain, with a modest 1-point decline. And then we have 3 countries who reported substantial declines. These 3 countries are Great Britain, Russia, and South Africa. Each reported a PMI decline of 3 points or greater. Now, we all expect that South Africa is in economic trouble, but both Britain and Russia are a bit of a surprise. And this indicates that these 2 countries that bookend Europe are struggling to maintain economic momentum. Although neither country is in a recession currently, this is an early warning sign that times are going to get a little tough for both the British and the Russians. Well, America has a labor problem. Of that, everyone can agree. Too many people are out of work in this country, and hence reliant on the generosity of the federal government just to make ends meet. Just moments ago, the U.S. Department of Labor announced that last week 385,000 more Americans marched to their local Department of Labor and applied for their unemployment insurance. This is always a traumatic experience. For most, it's an unnerving situation where you're never quite sure where to go or what you're required to do. But for those 385,000, it's a necessary step in putting their financial affairs back in order after they've lost their job. Now, we can point to just when unemployment became a serious issue in this country. It was at the beginning of 2020, February to be precise, when initial claims for unemployment, which for years before had averaged only about 200,000, suddenly shot up to over 6 million. It was the beginning of the pandemic, a pandemic that would wreak havoc on everyone, and especially those poor souls who lost their jobs. In that first week of February, over 6 million filed their unemployment claims, and altogether, over 22 million were put out of work. And this is the point that I think so many are missing. These people were fired, laid off, terminated. This was not something they chose. They didn't decide to go sit at home and eat bonbons. They did not think it was preferable than going to work. Yet that's what many in the press would have you believe. These are people whose jobs were taken away from them. The choice was not theirs, but their employers. And, if the truth be known, it really might not have been always the employer. Many times, I dare say likely most of the time, it was the employer's business that went out, and everyone was put on the street, from the shop owner to the worker. You see, for many, these workers were employed by a business that was determined to be non-essential. That's a term we had never heard before the pandemic. It was the designation by governors, mayors, and agency heads that a particular business would have to close. It was all part of the personal quarantine, social isolation, and distancing that was used as a strategy to curb the spread of the pandemic. The result was that an estimated 500,000 small businesses were forced to close for good. And small business collectively are the largest employers in the country. So when this number of small businesses were closed, the result was a huge jump in the rolls of the unemployed. Now, worst of all, most of those small businesses have not come back. They're closed for good. And this is what makes the current employment picture structural. You see, small business serves a niche for workers that big corporations simply cannot fill. For the worker who wants to work close at home, or part-time, or with friends and family, he chooses a small business. The chances are that it's a small business that will hire them. It's a very specific group of workers. And big corporations, with most often rigid hours, strict terms of employment, little personal flexibility, simply don't meet that worker's needs. But the mom-and-pop shops often do. And the small businesses will often cater to meet the needs and requirements of their workers, something you don't often see in the HR departments of the Fortune 500 companies. So while it's true that most people will elect to work for a large corporation with their enhanced benefits, set vacation times, and security, still, there are others who seek out the small shop with a personal feeling and, yes, usually a smaller paycheck. And it's these people who have lost many of the small businesses that they used to work for. I think that's the real reason we have well over 10 million long-term unemployed. It's because we lost those corner shops and stores that made up the small businesses in America. Well, in just a few minutes, we'll get the latest wholesale inventory reports. Now, this is a rather obscure economic report, which few analysts outside the retail group pay much attention to. However, it's one of the most important measures of just how all of us are faring in this current climate. Wholesale inventories are, as you would suppose, a measure of just how many goods and products the stores that we shop at have in stock, ready to sell to us. We all remember last year's run on paper products, which caused the shelves in our local supermarket to empty out. Toilet paper, paper towels, and napkins were impossible to buy. Markets across the country have worked hard to see that this does not happen again. But still, to the observant shopper, there are items that are clearly in short supply. And this is doubly the case if you need to order a specific replacement item, say a specialty part for a used car, or a particular houseware piece that you need to complete a set. Oh, you can get it all right, but it will take several weeks. And the financial press has pointed out for some time that this is all a result of the problems in the supply chain. That's another way of saying that it's a slow boat from China. Our global suppliers are still working their way through the worldwide logjam that was all part of last year's economic lockdown. We are still reading of the excess traffic at the nation's West Coast shipping ports. And certainly, these supply chain issues are the main reason that we're experiencing problems at the neighborhood store. But there's another issue here, and it's the just-in-time inventory management that has been a driving force behind the way that most retailers have operated for over a generation now. Born in the halls of academe, it was the idea that retailers should only purchase just enough inventory to carry them through the next several days of sales. Why put an item on your shelf when you can ask the marketer of that product to keep it on his shelf, and then have it delivered to you just in time for it to be sold? Neat, huh? Retailers thought so, This reduced one of the retail's principal expenses, inventory financing, and added directly to the retailer's bottom line. It was a clear win for retailers. But as retail's supply chain expanded globally, they were no longer looking to American suppliers who might be just down the street. Retailers were now looking to suppliers who were literally around the world. The average time for a supply ship to work its way from China to the west coast of the U.S. is about 8 weeks. Add to that the time from, say, San Pedro to Chicago or New York, and you now understand why the store you went to said it will take a few weeks to get that specialty item you ordered. Put this all together, and you see that just-in-time is a wonderful but provincial way to save money. In a world of global supply chains and subject to political and, as we've seen, pandemic interruptions, we've reached the limit of just-in-time inventory management. And you're seeing that today in the wholesale inventory numbers. Slowly and somewhat reluctantly, we're seeing businesses increase their inventory as the realization that long-range supply chains just aren't as reliable as they thought they were. Over the past year, we've seen wholesale inventories advance over 10%. That's a giant move and represents a huge expenditure on the part of retailers in particular. Now, in about an hour, we'll see the latest in wholesale inventories reported, and although the street expects a somewhat slower build today, up less than 1% is the expectation, just remember, this is on top of that 10% build this year. Wholesale inventories, one of those little-watched economic indicators that can have a big impact on your and my shopping experience. And that's Value Side for the weekend of August 7 and 8. I'm your host, David Revelle. Please join me in praying that our country may get back to work.